What's up, guys?
Hello.
Hey, everyone. If I haven't met you before, my name is Mark Legg. I graduated from Dallas Baptist University in May with a degree in Biblical Studies and Philosophy. And I have been passionate about philosophy for since I was in high school. And I was pretty sure in high school, I was like, this is crazy. This is pretty much the nerdiest thing. Well, you're hearing a lot of nerdy things today, but I wanted to be a professor when I was in high school in philosophy. And so I'm in between grad school right now. I just finished my undergrad, like I said. So I'm really happy to share my passion with you today. I'm really excited to do that with you. And I'm really honored that anyone would come and just hear a guy in his young 20s who, you know, is just passionate about philosophy. And I can share that with you. Let's start with what philosophy actually is. Philosophy is a root from two Greek words, philos and sophia. Does anyone at this who goes to this church, you may know, my dad teaches on this sometimes, on the Greek words for, does anyone know what philos? Love. What's the Greek word? Love, that's right.
Sorry.
Brotherly love, that's correct, yeah, affection or brotherly love. This one's a little bit harder. Does anyone know what sophia means? Yes.
Wisdom.
That's correct. Awesome. Give you a high five for that. Yes, wisdom. The love of wisdom. And I just want to pause and say, I think that that's so cool. Okay? It's not ology, like psychology. That comes from the Greek word logos, which is like reason. It's word. It's logic. Okay? It's not ology. It's love. It's the love of wisdom. I think that's kind of cool. Now, that poses the question, if philosophy is the love of wisdom, why do we go to anywhere other than the Bible for wisdom? And I think we ought to answer that question. So, Chris Sherrod talked a little bit this morning about why we study worldview. Okay, why it's important, right? But specifically, why do we want to get wisdom from places other than the Bible? There's a couple of reasons. One is that we approach the Bible with our own worldview, whether we know it or not. That's why it's important to take a step back, to take the glasses off, so to speak, and examine them. Okay? The second reason is because we have to relate what the Bible teaches, the wisdom of the Bible, to today, to the culture today, because they have their own wisdom. We have to figure out, how do we make these work? How do we approach the culture's wisdom with the Bible's wisdom? We have to understand what the culture believed before we can even do that. Okay? The third reason is that I believe some of these thinkers that I will talk to you about today have a lot of wisdom to offer us. They may not be from the Bible, and many of them are avid atheists. Nonetheless, I believe that they have a lot of wisdom. We'll talk about one thinker in particular named Nietzsche. And Nietzsche was avidly opposed to the idea of God. He was an atheist, and he thought Christianity was not a good system. Nonetheless, I believe he has a lot of wisdom for Christians, and I'll explain why later. As I go through these thinkers, I want you to take a couple notes here, a couple caveats. I will be presenting to you what I think is the best of them, and I'll be trying to sell them, basically, but I don't necessarily believe what they believe. Okay? Does that make sense with everyone? And I believe firmly that I'm going to try and represent them as best as I can, and that's the best way to move forward. I'm not going to try and misrepresent them. I'm not going to try and just discount them out of hand. I'm going to actually give them the dignity of trying to say what they're saying. So if you get scared, what is he saying? Does he believe that? No, probably not. Okay. But I'm just letting you guys know, as we begin this, we're going to do that. So what are we trying to accomplish today? We have this super fancy whiteboard. Isn't that awesome? It's so amazing. And then check this out too. You can shift slides. So great. What I'm going to do is draw. Here we go. Hold your breath. Pretty good.
Very good line.
Thank you. That's best as it's going to get right there. This is a timeline. And I'm going to start putting thinkers down here. And hopefully by the end, especially when we get to the modern period, we'll be able to trace back and you'll start to see instances of oh, that sounds familiar. Ooh, that sounds like the culture. And you'll start to see slowly, as the thinkers develop on each other, build on each other, you will eventually arrive where you are today. And you'll be able to trace that back through a few hundred years ago. Okay? That's pretty cool. I think that's going to be awesome. So hopefully we succeed in that. I think we did pretty well the first hour. So with that, let's jump into it. With Western philosophy, we're going to start with the Greeks. About the 300, 400 BC. What does that mean?
It means
before Christ. That's exactly right. So this is before Jesus is even born. We had a lot of philosophy going on. We had to start with, let's start with Plato and Aristotle. They were Greek philosophers, and Plato in particular, we're going to show how these two thinkers became the pillars upon which all of Western philosophy is built on. Okay? They are two separate pillars, and you'll see why in a moment. But they're the foundation that we build all of philosophy on. Plato approached philosophy by dialogues, meaning it's just a conversation. Remember when my dad was talking about how we have a conversation and we kind of develop towards the truth as we converse because we know that there's a reality out there? This is how Plato did it. He also did it by referring to his teacher named Socrates. You've heard of the Socratic method? We've heard of that. What does that mean?
Questioning.
Yes, ma'am. So, what you do, the Socratic method, he would go around and gather other philosophers, gather young people, and just start asking them questions. What do you think about this? What do you think about physics? What do you think about this truth? They would begin to pick it apart, and eventually he would show how they were wrong, but that they had come to a better understanding of the truth along the way. That's where we began in Western philosophy, was with Plato. And in his dialogues, he would have his teacher, Socrates, talking with someone else, and or sometimes multiple people, and they'd just be having a conversation. I fell in love with philosophy through the Republic, if you've heard of that from Plato. Plato wrote it down because Socrates didn't write anything down. So Plato took down notes like that, set up the dialogues, all of that, and had his own philosophy as well. We'll dig in a little bit into what Plato's philosophy is. He was big on asking questions, like we already mentioned. It was the Socratic method. So asking questions is super important. And it's kind of like Western philosophy is trying to answer those big questions. He asked them so well, we've just been trying to answer his questions that he had 2,300, 400 years ago. It's crazy. We're still asking these questions today. The one that I have as an example today is the one and the many. Okay, the one and the many. What does that mean? Holland, you say that's a pretty good chair.
Pretty good.
No. You would call it good?
Yeah.
9 out of 10?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good chair. Very good chair. Pretty comfortable. Holds up your bottom. You're all sitting there. Okay, what's your favorite food?
No idea.
Okay.
Pizza.
Huh?
Pizza.
Pizza. Okay, what's your favorite restaurant? That's okay. You're not going to get graded on this.
We went to FD's and that was very good.
FD's, pizza at FD's. Okay.
No.
Oh, no? Okay, I didn't think that was a pizza place. Okay. It's okay. We'll just say pizza. Okay. You say pizza is good? Well, hold on a second. Chair and pizza. Those things don't share very much, do they? But you just called them the same thing. You just called them good, didn't you? So many things participate in one thing. The problem of the one and the many. How does something like a chair, which has basically nothing in common with pizza, how can they both be good? Okay? One and the many. He answered this by what is called the form theory. We start at the very bottom with an image of the thing. So we can think of it as representation, as like a painting or a drawing, like I did right here. And this is called the shadow of the thing. Then we have the thing itself. This will all make sense in a second. Trust me. And these are different ways of thinking about the chair. Well, let's look at this chair in particular. This is a thing. It's a particular. There's one of these kinds of chairs. I mean, there could be ones that look like them. They're in the other classroom. But this is the one thing. The thing. Then we have, now everyone, all the kids here, please, and all the adults too, stay with me. This is math. Yay. Someone said yay. It's okay, we don't need to go in depth into this, but just note that there's like geometry in your chair. Like there's a triangle in there. Like on your chair, it's a tripod. So there's mathematical principles. There's logic that applies to your chair. But can someone show me math? Can anyone like hand it to me? No. You can't really, can you? So this is the physical world. This is the non-physical world. Non-physical world that still applies to reality. It's just not something you can sense with your senses. Not something you can see, touch, taste, whatever. The next step in reality is what's called the form of the thing. And the form exists, again, you can't see it, but it's basically the perfect chair. There's an ideal chair out there. And insofar as this chair is a chair, it participates with the form of the chair. That's a little bit crazy. We don't think about this way anymore, but this is how he presented reality. Now, what you do to learn about things, let's pause for a second. We need to cover one more section. We're moving beyond the non-physical now. We're going into the transcendent realm. And this is the good, the true, and the beautiful. These things we can call pizza good. We can call a chair good. It's the one. But you can sit for as long as you want and try and define good, and eventually you're going to reference good again. Okay? You cannot non-circularly define good. I'm sorry, it's just not gonna happen. You'll be like, well, good is good because it's good. Do the same thing with truth. I mean, I know we talked a lot about truth earlier in the speaker sessions, but good luck. It's true because it's true. It's not false. Yeah, not false. Okay, and there's such thing as beauty, but you can't define beauty without referencing beauty again. So these are things that just are. They just are. Now, the way to learn about things, let's say you want to learn about politics. Well, you start in the shadows. You start with an analogy, kind of like in the shadow. Then you talk about real-world examples. You talk about the thing of politics. Then you talk about the principles behind it, the math of the like, you know, what economics works. We have to think about it mathematically. And then we go to the form of the thing. What's the perfect society? Then we get to what is good about the society, what's true. This is how we learn things, according to Plato. Now notice, this is the Platonic method. He goes back down. So once you've gotten up here, you go back down, and then you go back up again. And the next time you go back up, you get a little bit more understanding of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And you just keep going. You go back down, back up, back down. And he would do this in the dialogues, in the conversations back and forth. You would talk about an analogy, and then you would talk about this, and it would move along like that. Okay? Now, what Aristotle, his student did, is come along and say, that's kind of bogus, man. Forms, what are you talking about forms? Wait, there's some perfect chair? That seems kind of ridiculous. I said it a little bit differently than that, but. the form of the thing, he said, no, there's such thing as categories. So that if you think about something like a movie, he talked about Greek tragedies. So like a movie, you have the plot, you have the story arc, you have the characters. So these are like little categories of the thing. So to understand truth, Aristotle said you have to look at the categories of the thing itself. You remember in class, this has served me no purpose in life, but you remember learning about kingdom, family, class, genus, species? That's something that this doesn't has never helped me practically know them. But it's an analogy of like, you know, bigger thing than a smaller category, and that's how you learn about things. Does that sound suspiciously like science to anyone? Okay, it does, doesn't it? This is why you can see how Aristotle and Plato are both the pillars of Western philosophy, but they're not saying exactly the same thing, are they? They're approaching either through the analytical, which is Aristotle, or through the kind of big question asking through Plato and Socrates. Okay? Now, the Greek thinkers, at this time, there was a lot of philosophers. There was the school of Athens. There was all of these, there's this great thinking being done. There's poetry. There's Homer's writing stuff. That was before that, but there's Homer writing things. There's all of this vibrant community of philosophy and art and all that stuff going on in the Greek time. Rome comes in, takes over the Greeks, and adopts their culture. So they combine Rome and Greek culture, mush them together, and you get Hellenism. Okay? So then you move along and you get more Roman philosophers who think a lot like Greek philosophers. Okay, you have people like Cicero. You have the continuation of people like Stoics, Epicureans. You have guys like Lucretians. Okay? So eventually, you get... So, again, to reiterate, Plato and Aristotle were about 300s BC. About 150 AD, you get a man named Marcus Aurelius. And he was a Stoic Greek philosopher. But he was a Roman emperor. Okay? So you see how widespread and how influential the Greek thinking was. So we can call this time period Greek thinking, or we could call it the ancient period. Okay. So far, so good? Okay. Next, we have a thinker named St. Augustine. A curious, kind of funny thing happened where Rome, because of an emperor named Constantine, converted to Christianity, didn't it? That's kind of weird. Christianity has always been defined essentially as an oppressed minority group of religious thinkers. I mean, that's how Christians thought of themselves, being persecuted by the government. That's how they defined themselves. I'm saying themselves. I mean, I'm a Christian too, by the way. But just saying, like, that's not like all that there is, of course. But that's part of it. And all of a sudden, it's flipped on its head. Now all of Rome is Christian. So then you get this switch right before you have someone like St. Augustine. Interestingly, St. Augustine was not a Christian for a while. His mother was a Christian, and his mom prayed for him for his whole life. And eventually, he discovered Neoplatonism, which just means new. Neo means new. New Platonism. And said, maybe there is something transcendent out there. It's not all just about the physical, what I sense. It's not just about the physical passions. There's something more to life. So he begins as a Neoplatonist and eventually ends up as a Christian after he has a mystical experience, basically, as a vision. Okay? Now, we get a lot of our theology, actually, from St. Augustine. He developed the idea of sin nature. Okay? That was him. So he's a theologian, and he's also a brilliant philosopher. If you go to the back of the Confessions, people normally skip over this part, but the last few chapters of the Confessions, which is a story about his life, is literally philosophy of time and being. Like, where did this come from? It's like an autobiography, and all of a sudden it's philosophy. It's very interesting. So he's a theologian, philosopher, extremely influential. Now, unfortunately, what happens is basically all these guys get banned because they're pagans. Okay, so they're pagans, so all the church who's now in charge says, oh, we can't have that. So all of them basically are not translated into Latin, so, you know, even the scholars can't read them. And you have a lot of theological scholarly thinking here in terms of theology, but you don't have many great thinkers. St. Augustine was around 300-ish, 400, okay, AD. And then you just don't get anything until 1000. Okay? There are some people that you can study, but it just wasn't valued as much. Okay? You don't have this populated tons of brilliant thinkers and art kind of stagnated in this period and all of that. Okay, again, as I said, there's not much growth. Part of the influence, ironically, of Neoplatonism can be found in this. In this position in medieval society, peasants are low, priests are high. Okay, worth more, because they're more spiritual. So remember the line I drew a second ago? This is what it looked like, in case you forgot. This is like the spiritual for the Neoplatonist Christians. And so they thought the spiritual was better than the physical, which I think is a misreading of Plato, but that's what they thought. And so you see the consequences of ideas at this time. Until around 1000, as I said. I'm going to stretch this out a little bit further. Then you have a man named St. Anselm. Okay? St. Anselm came along and started to do scholarly work. And at this time, you have Oxford being founded. You have the University of Paris being founded. And there became this resurgence in rational, scholarly thinking. Okay? So St. Anselm still drew a lot of influence from someone like Plato, and eventually they began to be legalized and translated from Greek to Latin. Okay? So remember, all these dudes are still monks. I mean, he eventually became a bishop, but he was basically a monk. So we're talking about Christians still, okay? He's a very strong believer. Then you have St. Thomas Aquinas came right after, okay? Anselm was around 1100. Aquinas was around 1200, 1300-ish. He kind of was in that period. And he wrote this, it was called the Summa Theologiae, because it was just the summary of philosophy, and theology. Summa Theologiae, summary of theology. So, you know, it was just like a starting out, like a little handbook, really easy to... that's a joke, because the Summa Theologiae, the summary of philosophy... summary of theology is this big. He wrote it himself. It is a study of philosophical theology. Okay? He systematically, analytically, just like Aristotle, starts to break down issues of the most basic questions. What is real? What is time? Who is God? What is he like? He referenced the Bible, most of all, because he was a believer. If he couldn't get answers there, he referred to natural philosophy of that given by Aristotle. So you'll see him quote, he just calls him the philosopher, and he's referring to Aristotle, because he's so important. So he references Aristotle and builds upon that. So he has Aristotle, even a Muslim philosopher named Avicenna, the Bible, and then his own reason. When I say analytical, let me just pause here, because the Summa Theologiae is built, it's built different, okay? kids get that, it's okay. So it's taken apart into parts, then into sections, then into questions, then to answer those questions into multiple articles. And then in each article, he has two or three objections, which are views from other people. He gives a quote from someone else called On the Contrary. Then he gives his own opinion, which is, but I say that. Then he responds to each of the objections. Wrap your mind around that. And this is on topics like angels have emotions. I mean, we're getting specific here. And he does that from the start of what even is God. He has this massive, expansive analytics, okay? Now, you can see how this turned from the, okay, there's not much going on, to... now, these brilliant guys come along. Now, if I were living in that time, I would look at Aquinas and think, man, that's pretty great. Look at humans go. Look at what humans can do. Okay. This was birthed... I'll get to you in a second here. Oh, I spelled it there. This birthed a movement called the Renaissance. Okay, before we move on. Yes,
I don't remember you giving like a general time. Sorry.
No, for which, sorry. So yeah. 1000 was when university started to be, mm-hmm. to pop up. Then you had Anselm, who was around 1100s. Mm-hmm. Then Aquinas was around 1200.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before we move on, that covers the Middle Ages. Does anyone have any questions here?
How long did it take him to write that book?
Many years.
Very, very long time.
Very long time, and he didn't finish either.
Oh.
Yep. In fact, not because he died, but because he gave it up. And he had an experience, this is interesting, he had an experience where he met the Lord in prayer or something like that, but he was just communing with Jesus and looked back on the Summa Theologiae. You know what he said? It's straw. It's straw compared to our Lord. There is no way that that can do justice to God. Isn't that cool? I think that's amazing. So, yeah.
Did he ever end up publishing it?
Oh, yeah. Yep, you can read all of it. yes, if you want.
In Latin.
In Latin. Yeah, no, in English, too. But this is the crazy thing is people to this day spend their whole lives studying the Summa Theologiae. Mm-hmm. Exactly. The Franciscan Order of Monks, a lot of people in the Catholic Church, still study this rigorously, and other philosophers too, because he's such a brilliant philosopher. Okay, good question. So again, brilliant. There's a lot more thinkers, by the way. A lot more scholars. John's Duns Scotus, many more. Okay? And then you have the Renaissance. Now, can anyone name 4 Renaissance artists?
Leonardo.
You got it? That's
Raphael.
Our Dante.
Raphael.
Michelangelo.
Leonardo.
That's right. Those are the 4. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles of the Renaissance. So I think the best way to think about the Renaissance is actually in one of the sculptures. Okay, because this was an artistic movement in the 1500s, started in the 1400s, in the 1500s, we're at that point now, that rebirthed the Roman ideal, okay? This became the central focus of people in the Renaissance. They were still Christians, by and large. Whether they were actual Christians or just on the surface is, you know, probably debated a lot. But you do have this renewal of thinking, because as soon as these guys get translated into Latin, everyone's studying them. What do they say? What do they think? And there's this glorified view of Rome at this point. In fact, Dante, who wrote in this time, you know, the Inferno, you guys know what I'm talking about? He wrote also Purgatory and Comedy, which is about heaven. But in the Inferno, you know who's at the center of hell? Does anyone know? You know, you got the rings and you go deeper and deeper and it gets worse and worse. Satan, of course. Judas. And one other person. Brutus.
Oh.
From Rome. Isn't that fascinating? So anyway, that just goes to show you that they were really thinking about Romans. And they were really loving Rome a lot. I mean, obviously not Brutus, but... okay. So, we get to the Renaissance period. And I think the best way to summarize the Renaissance is by thinking about Michelangelo's David. Okay? The idealized male form, you know? Perfect proportions, and it's like massive. It's like what, like 20 or 30 feet tall, this massive statue of David, and he's looking ahead to the future, and he's confident, and he's optimistic, and he believes in humanity. Okay, it is the idealization of humans. It's called humanism. That was the central thought during the Renaissance, was that you and I are pretty amazing. Humans are awesome. Look at us go. What do you think we can accomplish? And no wonder, because there's some brilliant, beautiful things produced in the Renaissance. And this led to a guy in the 1600s named Descartes. Okay, now, Descartes is extremely important. He is a fulcrum. Oh, dude, we're doing good on time. He's a fulcrum, okay, upon which all of philosophy shifts. So it's really important to get Descartes. We'll spend a little bit more time on him, who is a French philosopher. As I said, philosophized during the 1600s. And his conviction was that since individuals are pretty great, he figured, well, let me back up a little bit. He thought that, you know how whenever you're on Facebook or any social media and someone just sends you something and you're like, that's pretty dubious. Where did this come from? So he had that idea about authority. So you remember my dad this morning talking about one source of truth is from authority? He thought, well, you know, when people tell me stuff, they turn out to be wrong quite a bit. So maybe I can't trust authority a lot. In fact, what I've been told has been by my parents. When he says that, it's like what my parents brought me up in, right? It's what I've been told to believe. So what do I believe? So what he did fundamentally is say, okay, the best way to come to truth is to just have a chair. You just sit by yourself, alone, in peace and quiet. Maybe get a nice fire going, maybe get some tea. And just spend all day by yourself. No dialogue like Plato. Just think. What do I believe? And what you have to do is systematically tear down what you believe or have been told to believe. He saw his worldview as a massive house. And he tore it down, brick by brick, plank by plank, and tore up the foundation. That was what his convictions were, is that you have to be able to reflect and reject everything and start from ground zero. Okay? Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, so you're at ground zero. Now what? You've become skeptical of everything. And when I say skeptical of everything, I mean really. So he started with, like Dad brought up with the illusion. Okay, remember that? That was pretty wild. The two gray blocks that turned out to be the same color. Said, so maybe we can't trust our senses so much. You put a straw in water and it bends, right?
Refraction.
Refraction, exactly. What do we do with that? Our senses. Maybe they're not so trustworthy. Let's take it a step further. So we've doubted authority. We've doubted our own senses. What if we're all in a dream? What if I'm in a dream? Have you heard of like the brain in the vat kind of idea? It's like, what if I'm just a brain in a vat and scientists are, you know, my brains are like, think things, you know? What if we're in a dream? We've all had dreams where we're convinced it's real. Whoa. You know?
Like the Matrix.
It's like the Matrix. The Matrix. It's like Inception. All that stuff. Oh, yeah. That's a good one to think through. So, he even goes so far, so then he goes even further. And he said, what if there's an all-powerful demon that is tricking me? Whoa. To think things that aren't really real. How can I get out of that? So, his whole philosophy pivots on the one thing he can be certain of. Do you know what it is? It's cogito ergo sum. Close.
I think, therefore, I am.
Ah, okay. Verb, therefore, subject. Okay? Doubting, therefore, there's something that's doing the doubting. Thinking, therefore, there's something that's doing the thinking. I think, comma, therefore, I am. So he knows that he exists. That's basically it, but which is crazy to think about. But he does this.
One more here.
He has a very strong distinction between the subject and the object. Now, someone said, this gentleman over here said, God, and we'll get to that in a second. Subject, I'm perceiving things that are out there. Object, I'm the subject. In fact, from my point of view, all of you are objects. So. Right, you could all be figments of my imagination. But basically, the idea is we start from knowing that the subject is real, and there's a strong emphasis on the subject. It's really hard to be certain about this until we build from it. So his conviction was, if you can tear down your own beliefs to a point where it's just simple, you know, like, and you can get down to, if you have a certainty, like, I think, therefore I am, you can be, you have a clear understanding, a clear and distinct perception, is what he calls it, of that, so you can move on. So, a triangle has three sides. That's a clear, distinct perception. I can know that that's true. I'm certain about that. So once you're certain about things like that, you can prove God exists, is what he thinks. So he develops this proof, says God exists, God's got to be perfect, so he's not going to fool me. So I can kind of trust that this is actually there. Because God's not going to systematically fool me because he's perfect. Okay? So he tried, he was skeptical, radically skeptical about everything, and then from ground zero, tried to build it back up so he was certain about certain truths. But the conviction that rationality and logic will get you there, as long as you break it into small enough parts. Okay? Questions so far about Descartes?
Were drugs involved?
He's a mathematician as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Yes, he was a geometrician, mathematician, logician, whatever you want to call him. He did this up too, but yes, that's correct. He was a mathematician. These guys were awesome. They were so brilliant. They could do so many things. Okay, we're going back here. Got Descartes. And from Descartes, from that tipping point, we have what's called the Enlightenment. Okay, we're getting a little bit closer here, aren't we? The Enlightenment. It's actually not that big. It's just not true size. It's a pretty small period of time for how impactful it was.
What century are we in?
We are in the 18th century, so 1700s. So Descartes was 1600s, mid, late 1600s. And then that births the Enlightenment, which is in the 1700s. Good question. So we're at the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment is built on the foundation that as long as we can get the big problems small enough to be logical about them, consistently, dogmatically, methodically, we just go through and break it down like a math problem. And then we use that to interpret our experiences. So it's all very much experiential, and it's what's called empirical. Heard of empiricism? It's basically the idea, especially it's science. If you think about what science is, it's just observing and then computing it so that it makes sense. Okay? Now, what the Enlightenment thinkers thought is that, as Descartes did, without authority and without religion, so those are the chief things, he did his project without authority. The Enlightenment thinkers said, anyone, anywhere, as long as they think hard and long enough, they will get to the correct conclusion. Okay? Well, I'm pretty skeptical of that, but that's what they thought. And that your mind was like a blank, so tabula rosa, it was John Locke. Tabula rosa means blank slate. Okay? Whenever you're born, John Locke thought, you're a blank slate. And your mind basically passively receives data from the world, and then you build your worldview from that. Okay? There's no like built-in rules about what's right or wrong. It's very passive. Senses imprint on your mind, and you can build science out of that. Okay, so they did something similar to what Descartes was doing, because Descartes is trying to do like one step at a time. Okay. A man came along named not much space here, but you'll have to. Rousseau. He was right in the middle of the Enlightenment. He was 1700s. Now, if you figure, okay, if everyone can figure stuff out for themselves, that means that they should probably have freedom. Maybe liberty, that pursuit of happiness. Okay. So that means that every individual has a right Okay. Now, when Rousseau was thinking about this stuff, he believed that your conscience is true and the same across people. Now, this is something I want to know. I don't want to forget this. Enlightenment thinkers believed in universal truths, even though they were built on experience. Does that make sense? It's kind of like science. You know, science stays the same no matter where you go. Go to China, same science there. Okay? That's their conviction, at least. And so they thought that these answers could be brought up by basically the scientific method, examining these rational things. So Rousseau thought, okay, if I turn inward and I find my conscience which tells me what to do, right and wrong, good from evil. But he's saying to turn inward. Okay? Keep note of that. Because this is a movement from looking outward for truth and morality to inward to truth and morality. He still believes it is universal, right? So you and I will have the same conscience, but we're looking inward. And he thought the only reason, when he looked back on his life, he thought, you know, the only reason when I really messed up was when society got in the way. It was when I was peer pressured by my friends. I never did anything wrong if I trusted myself. That's what he thought. This is in radical opposition to St. Augustine, who wrote a book called Confessions, which was an autobiography, and then he told a story and said, look at how much I messed up. I'm a sinner in need of the grace of God. Rousseau said, he wrote a book called Confessions also. Interesting, right? And in it, he accounts whenever he messed up something, and he did it because a friend peer pressured him to. So his solution is, right, society needs to allow the most freedom possible, because if we trust our own conscience, then we will get somewhere. So this is what you could call the psychologizing of human nature. Human nature is not about what other people tell me I am, it's about what I observe in myself. Yes, ma'am? Did you have a question?
I did.
Yes, ma'am.
When did it turn from these thinkers being primarily believers to... I mean, you didn't say that about Descartes and Rousseau, so maybe I'm wrong, but...
Yes, ma'am. Descartes was a Christian. In fact, remember whenever we talked about him tearing the house down?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yes, you did.
Yes, ma'am. He said that he built a little log cabin, or like a little cabin, which was the Christian worldview that he would live in while he teared down his other worldview. All his worldviews. Does that make sense? So he was kind of like, oh, while I'm tearing down, I have to believe something. So I'm going to believe because I have the conviction that Christianity is true. Anyway, however, Rousseau, don't think so. Enlightenment thinkers sometimes were like pretty surface level Christians. They were Christians. But David Hume, I mean, you still kind of had to say you were a Christian at this point. David Hume is a prime example. He was definitely an atheist. He was an Enlightenment thinker. I think he still talks about God sometimes, though. Not because he actually believed in it, because he kind of had to not get in trouble. Okay? But it's pretty clear that he did not believe in God. I'm not an expert in Enlightenment thinkers, let me just say that. So, that's a good question. But it will turn the second. It will radically shift, and you'll see why. So, Enlightenment thinkers, they're still convicted of this, of the scientific kind of truth. Rousseau comes along, says what he says, and says, it's best if society just got out of the way, and yes, had laws, had rules, all that, but they need to respect the individual rights of the person. And thus was born the American Revolution, and another revolution called the French Revolution. Okay, so the American Revolution was built on Enlightenment ideals, granted, but it also had at the base of Christian understanding, of Christian morals. Okay? The French Revolution did not, chiefly. Okay? It had, yes, the Enlightenment Foundation, it basically built word for word its constitution from Rousseau. And it failed miserably. Do you know what it was called in history when the French Revolution fell apart? Terror. It was just called the Terror. You think of guillotines? The Terror. I mean, people were being killed left and right. And chiefly, they were not only, let's do apart from religion, because all the Enlightenment thinkers were doing their thinking apart from religion. Whether they were Christians or not, they thought we don't need religion to tell us anything. So, what Rue, what the French Revolution did was they had animosity towards Christians. They burned churches. They thought religion was part of the problem. Okay? And you see how it failed. Do you know who came after the French Revolution?
Napoleon.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am. Napoleon Bonaparte. He came in and, ironically, swept up in a dictatorial, authoritarian regime. What was supposed to be on liberty and freedom and individual rights. Pretty ironic. So the French Revolution lasted for like 1 year. Okay, I mean, it was a miserably failed project. Right before the French Revolution, and during it, was writing a man named Immanuel Kant. This, it is no exaggeration to say that philosophers nowadays think in two ways. You categorize all of history into pre-Kantian and post-Kantian. Okay? That is how important Kant is. And I'll show you why in a second. He is another fulcrum point, even probably more than Descartes. I mean, it is hard to overstate how important he is. Why? Well, he was an Enlightenment thinker. But after he came along, the Enlightenment fell apart. Okay, they were already reaching dead ends, and he knew that if we didn't have religion or like a basis for morality, we'd be done. We'd not be in a good spot, like in the French Revolution. He kind of was seeing the French Revolution coming. He knew that was coming, so he was trying to get ahead of the curve by writing what he wrote. Trying to save the Enlightenment, so to speak. He split the world into two categories. The phenomenal and the noumena. Okay, don't let those big words scare you. I just want to represent him well. Phenomenal is appearance. How things appear to you. And if you, as I'm teaching about this, and you think back to my dad's lecture about truth, and you're like, ooh, wait a second. Okay, that probably will happen. Appearance is in the phenomenal realm, in the reality, okay? In the reality of the appearance. Then in the noumena, there are the things as they are. Object, subject, basically. Okay. There's a little bit more nuance than that, but I'm trying to simplify it a little bit so we understand what's going on.
Excuse me, how do you spell
yes.
that?
Yeah. Atrocious. What is it, phenomenal?
No,
noumena. Noumena? N-O-U-M-E-N. Noumenal, actually, would be a better way to say it. Noumenal, N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L. Noumenal, things as they are. Oh boy, pay attention, because this is really important. Kant said, you can never know anything about things as they are, ever. Period. Full stop. You can only know how things appear. As far as I know, this is a coffee mug. As the thing as it is. But maybe it just appears to me. My touch is fooling me. My eyes are fooling me. Everything is fooling me. It appears as a pen. But maybe the thing as it is a coffee mug. And who are you to say otherwise? Because you can only see what appears to you. I don't believe this, by the way. But I'm just saying, this is what he thought. And you can see how it's pretty convincing. Now, he also thought that in the appearance of things, you could be consistent. So things do appear the same way to me and to you. Okay? So that's why physics works. That's why science works. He thought science was in this realm of the phenomenal, of how things appear. Science is the study of the phenomenal as things appear. It's consistent. Now, if you know much about Kant, or anything really, you probably know about his moral philosophy, which is deontological ethics. You guess, does that ring a bell a little bit, like somewhere in the back of your brain, like back when school? No, bummer. That's okay. Basically, it's a way of moral ethics that applies universally. As if you sat down to think about it long enough, you would get to right and wrong, logically. Okay, so he's not a relativist, is what I'm saying. He doesn't believe you and I have different views of science. He doesn't believe you and I have different views of morality. He just thinks that we can't know things as they are. Now, a big problem he saw was in things like science seems to show that there's such a thing called determinism. Which is what? It's basically like the chemicals in my brain cause me to do stuff. It's just like we're all dominoes. We have no free will. There's no control. He thought that empirical evidence kind of showed that. But that's a problem. Because if I say, killed a couple dozen people, but, I mean, you know, just a cog in the machine. I'm just one of the dominoes. You can't really blame me. I mean, it's just the chemicals in my brain just doing what they're doing. Obeying the laws of physics. So that's a problem for morality, isn't it? Now, he noticed that everyone believes in free will. And that for morality to succeed, you must believe in free will. But free will is something as it is. It is a thing as it is. So freedom, free will, is in this category. Something we can never know if it exists or not. But we have to believe it anyway. Okay? Everyone tracking with me so far? So you have to believe these things. You have to believe there really is a pin here, but you can just never know for sure. You have to believe like there's free will, but you can never know for sure. Do you know what else goes in this box? The first group didn't get it, but what else goes in there?
God.
That's right. Yes, God goes in there. This is why people debate and fight about whether Kant believes in God. Because, well, he does, but he doesn't know whether God exists or not. So you have to believe in these things, regardless of whether you can know they're true or not. So you see where this is starting to go? See where this is leading us? So ironically, what Kant was trying to do was show how these things work together. What he ended up showing as an Enlightenment thinker was people came after him and said, maybe that's just not real. Maybe these, like, things as they are, just don't. It's all in the how they appear. It's in the subject. Okay, so then you get the 1800s. And you get, I can't go into this in detail, but there's a group of people you can look up later, maybe the German idealists. Kant was German. Idealists are people who, they do believe in the ideal. We want to believe in the transcendent. But we have to believe that in spite of how logic looks. In spite of how reason looks. So you see how it become a fight against reason versus the ideal, versus God, versus free will. Reason and appearance, science versus God. So Kant didn't see it as verses. He thought, well, maybe God exists. Maybe things as they are exist, but we just can't know. But how it was brought forward from that point on, people weren't convinced by this. So the next thinker we're going to look at is a man named Friedrich Nietzsche, who you may have heard of. You may have heard Nietzsche. Some people say it that way. Potato, potato. This was a man who lived... We're getting close, guys. We're getting close to right here, which is, you know, 2021, okay? So Nietzsche was a German thinker who believed that the Enlightenment thinkers were too coward to admit that God did not exist, which answers your question a little bit. He said the Enlightenment thinkers knew that God didn't exist, but they just pretended like he did. And then he said he believed that that kind of, in that period you have the Victorian era, you know, like, I don't know, like mansions and dinner parties and things like that. He hated that stuff. He thought politeness as morality, he thought niceness as morality, was all facades. And this is someone who I'm going to sound passionate about because I think he's a really brilliant thinker, but I disagree with, like, almost everything he says. Okay, he's brilliant, and I'm passionate about him, but he also believed that God didn't exist. Okay, you may have heard God is dead. That comes from Nietzsche. He was a poetic thinker. He wrote in poetry a lot. He wrote in really brilliant ways of thinking, but he was wrong. Okay, remember how we talked about in the first session about truth? Now, he has some wisdom for Christians because he holds up a mirror to Christians and says, you don't look so good. Okay, so it can be convicting as a Christian to read Nietzsche because you're like, ooh, does he really think that about Christians? I say all that to say, I think there's a lot of wisdom in Nietzsche, even though he was an atheist. All that to say, Nietzsche thought that values, okay, when I say values, I mean like morality, like moral values, okay? It's good to be kind to someone. That's like a value, okay? Love is a value. He thought that because God was dead and because the Enlightenment thinkers couldn't get anywhere with morality, that all values that had been from this point onward were either, well, they were all invented. Okay? He thought that all values were invented to get power for yourself. So, for instance, for Christians, let me explain. Christianity says, you know, the meek will inherit the earth. The meek will inherit the earth. The first shall be last. Okay? He thought Christianity was the invention of religion to basically say that strong people were evil and weak people were good, therefore allowing weak people to gain power over strong people. It's called the genealogy of morals. Okay, it's like a history of morality. That's a really important claim that he made, that all of moral thinking is just people trying to get power for themselves. That's starting to sound familiar a little bit. So we'll get there. But I'm just pointing out, Nietzsche was very influential, and he thought that humanity had to become strong again and invent their own values, because there were no such thing as objective values. He was not a nihilist, okay? People think he's a nihilist. He wasn't. He did believe in values. He just thought that humans had to become the Übermensch, the Superman. That's how it translates from German. Interesting, right? We can probably see some parallels to some thinkers, okay? So, he believed in the arts and those kinds of things, and aesthetic beauty and all of that, but he just thought that they were invented by the human will to power. That's what he called it, the will to power. Now, I'm going to cover a few more thinkers that came a little bit later. During Nietzsche, a man named Charles Darwin wrote. Now, I don't know what your views on evolution are, but what people used Darwin and his scientific study to mean, they interpreted it to mean, that human nature is no better than animals, right? We all just evolved from apes, okay? So we're just basically animals. There's nothing, there's no value, it's all just like human nature is just as no more valuable than animals. And Nietzsche was kind of a contemporary sort of a Darwin and appreciated Darwin's work. Though Darwin never made any like philosophical claims, he said himself, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not an economist, like I don't know how life began, I'm just studying natural selection. Now, we move along to a man named Karl Marx. Darwin was 1800s, Nietzsche was 1800s, just to catch everyone up. Marx was late 1800s. Karl Marx, founder of communism. And he looked back at history and agreed with Nietzsche that it's all about power. All of history is not about people trying to come to the truth. It's just about people trying to get power for themselves, to keep themselves in their class, okay? To keep themselves in their economic superiority, their position above other people, okay? So he thought that religion, again, was invented. He believed that religion, so clearly by now, we've switched over to, God doesn't exist. That's become the norm, sort of, for most thinkers, okay? So Marx believed that we had to materially create this utopia, like communism,
to succeed and to grow. And he critiqued capitalism, right? But notice, he believed that human nature, again, nothing more than the material. Nothing, no greater purpose other than to gain power for oneself, building off the back of Nietzsche. And finally, the last thing I'm going to discuss today is a man named Sigmund Freud. Sorry, it just gets more and more atrocious handwriting. It's a fun little D. It looks like a Disney D. Yes, Sigmund Freud. So, at this point, let me trace where we've come so far, especially with human nature. We started with St. Aquinas. Humans are pretty great now that we think, I mean, he was a very humble man, all of that, but humans are pretty great, they can accomplish a lot of great things through their reason. We can take Descartes, where he said, any old person, as long as they can get alone and tear down their own worldview and build it back up, will get to the correct worldview. So then it becomes more individualistic. Right? Because Descartes didn't need anyone else. He just needed himself. He just needed to be alone in his room. Get some quiet time. The most introverted introvert I've ever studied, you know? Then you get to Rousseau, who said that you have to look inward for truth about morality. Your conscience is good. Right? Then you get to, you can't really know anything that's real. Okay? Immanuel Kant. Then you get to Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said, it's about inventing values. Then you get to Darwin, who said that humans aren't really much better than animals anyway. And Marx agreed. He said that we're just kind of machines. Material. So we have a psychological, individualistic way of thinking. And then we have Freud, who said that, yes, who's like the founder of psychology, right? What's that?
You said the Freudian slip of psycho.
Yes, psycho, exactly, yes. What I'll say about Freud is most of his stuff was like garbage. Okay, you can just toss most of that out.
Garbage,
absolute garbage. But he did provide some specific insights that were really helpful to modern psychology, which is a good thing, I would say. Psychology is a good thing. I'm not demonizing psychology, I'm just saying Freud was lunatic, okay? Now, so we have, it's all about going inward, it's all about individual, it's all about psychology. And Freud came along and said it's all about sex. And I'm not joking when I say everything is about that. Sorry for you kids in here, let's, uncomfortable to hear. But basically, I'm not exaggerating, he believed that civilization itself was just a stable way so that people could have sex more regularly and frequently. Basically, he thought that if we were cavemen and just did that whenever we wanted to, it would be better, except that we died a lot quicker when we were cavemen. So we've got to build a society, literally we have to build a society so that we can have regular sex. That is the primary human motivator, in his view. I don't agree with that. That's a terrible way to live. But I'm just saying, now you get this full picture. Nowadays, there's these thinkers called post-structuralists. That's a very scary word. That sounds really boring. And it is very boring. Basically, they married Marx and Freud and said it's all about power structures and about sex. And about social power. So Marx was about economic power, wasn't he? But they came along and said it's not just economic power. It's not just the rich oppressing the poor. It's the social elites oppressing the socially inferior. Post-structuralists, and then post-modernists, who said that morality was relative to where you were. Because language is what holds truth. And since you can change language, that means you can change truth. That's the basic way I can summarize the post-modernists. Okay? And voila. What you have a recipe for is anyone Is anyone seeing some parallels to today, how people think? Our culture? Yes. Okay. The best, so there's a book back there called, it's called Truman. It's called Expressive Individualism, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. So he concludes that where we are right now is an expressive individualism. We view ourselves as individuals, that we express our own morality, that we try and do whatever we can to gain power over other people, and that anything in history that's about morality, about objective morality, is about people trying to oppress you. Okay? Yes?
What's the second thing under...
Marx?
No.
Postmodern.
That.
Postmodern.
Oh, okay.
Theoretically, it says postmodern. So, I think the best way to view this, or think about this, and what he does at the beginning of the book is say, how did we get to transgenderism? Think about it for a second. That is a radical self-invention contrary to the physical reality of the world that I'm defining, that I base my identity on. It's a sexual thing. So they base their identity on it, like in Freud. And that they are oppressed because they are a minority. Now, I'm not going to talk about transgenderism. That's not the point of this talk. And we need to love those people so hard. Like, that is just terrible to think about, that anyone would be in that spot. So compassion and love is what those people need. But I'm just saying, you can see where that is not on face ridiculous now. It's actually common sense for people to say something like, I believe I'm a man stuck in a woman's body. That statement is taken like, oh yeah, of course, that's common sense. That's the world view. And you can see it building all the way to today. Let me close this out with a little last remarks. I say all that I say not to discount these thinkers on their face. As I said, there's already, I believe that there's wisdom in some of these thinkers, and many of these thinkers. We can toss out the garbage and keep what's true, because all truth is God's truth. There's a lot of garbage in there, but there's also a lot of truth. So you have to be able to discern what is right and wrong, true and false, based on what? On the Word of God. Remember, always, that our ultimate wisdom comes from God. And that's why we hold all things against the Word. And that we find the very truest wisdom there. Philosophy is the love of wisdom. The best wisdom we can find, the ultimate wisdom, is from the Lord through the Bible. I believe that any time the Word of God speaks against these philosophers are wrong. Objectively. Okay? I'll finish with the word of Scripture. In Proverbs 4, it says, get wisdom. Do not forsake her, and she will keep you. Love her, and she will guard you. That's all I got, guys.